Hello and welcome to the Reading Envy podcast. This is the podcast where Jenny gets people on to talk about books that they've read. Isn't that right?
It is. And today, of course, we're in the Science Fiction Book Review podcast pub.
Yep.
For a little change of scenery.
Yeah, so we've got some sound effects of a bar in the background. Yeah, so what we're doing is a crossover podcast talking about a book, which is, well, it's not a book, it's a short story collection. So I guess it's a book, but it's not a novel, let me put it that way. Normally I review novels and Jenny talks about lots of different stories on different books and stuff. This time we're talking about, actually, this is almost a three-way crossover podcast because we were both on the SFF audio podcast talking about a short story. It's not even a short story, it's like a novella, wasn't it, called The Girl Who Was Plugged In by James Tiptree Jr. And you really liked it. I can't remember which way around it went, but I think there was you, me, and Jesse, and maybe Tamahomi. I can't remember who. I think there was four of us on there. And then that was actually from a larger collection. So what did you think of that specific story? I can't remember what your... Because we won't probably talk about that one so much here because we've already included that.
It's one of my favorites.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, from this collection. And I remember you didn't like it as much. But we must have spent over an hour discussing just that one story. So I don't know how long we'll record about this book.
Well, I've only got a few hours. I mean, hopefully we'll get it. We'll sort of say some overall stuff. We'll go through some of our favorites, some of our least favorites. I don't think we need to talk about every single one of these stories anyway, because it's quite a big collection. I brought up the Wikipedia page here before. Oh, it doesn't say the numbers. But what, like 20 stories? 15, 18 stories or something?
Yeah,
so
20.
In that book, The Girl Who Was Plugged In, Jenny really liked it. I think Jesse really liked it. And then I was not so much of a fan, mainly because I think I go through phases where I kind of get sick of things. I just can't do any cyberpunk anymore. And this Girl Who Was Plugged In was from 1973, like before cyberpunk became a thing, but is actually quoted or like listed as an influence or cited as an influence by people like, William Gibson. He was like, yeah, this is one of those things that inspired me or was one of the inspirations for the kind of cyberpunk literary aesthetic. I don't know what to say, because I'd say something like Blade Runner is kind of a would even though that's kind of a cyberpunk feel to it, even though it's a movie, I think that movie is very much what something like Neuromancer feels like. You know, it's got that look. Even though it's written, it's not a look, but it's sort of like, oh, okay, we're gonna be in that kind of world. Whereas The Girl Who Was Plugged In isn't like that, but it kind of informs more of the kind of literary style or the literary approach. I'm not even quite gonna say it, like the cyberpunk approach rather than the cyberpunk world. I don't know. It's a strange one.
Yeah, and it's funny because I did reread all these stories this weekend.
Yes?
And
oh, you got through all of it again.
When I reread that one, it's probably my fifth read of that story.
Yeah.
What really stuck out to me this time had nothing to do with the cyberpunk stuff and more about how dangerous advertising is and the lies and the fakeness of all of that world. And I thought, you know, maybe that's really more what this is about, at least this time.
Yeah. Well, for me, I never really thought the advertising in the future is a legal premise. That never really held up for me. It was like, okay, we're just using this to get into this other situation of celebrity and all that kind of, you know, and what I could enjoy, but it was like, just overall, I didn't really, but that is probably the most cyberpunkish story in this collection. And I didn't know that at the time. I'd never read any of James Tiptree Jr. before, and I think you just said no, just get the full book and just read through, there'll be stuff you liked. And spoiler alert for this podcast, I really enjoyed a lot of this book, not all of them.
I saw you gave it 5 stars.
Well, it's one of those weird things, because I don't normally, like, for this podcast, I won't rate this book, because for short story collections, it's really difficult to rate a collection, because some of these stories for me are 5-star books. Well, I'm not even sure any individual story would be a 5-star story. There are a few which are very good, but for me, like, this collection is just one of the strongest collections. And I think we can talk a little bit about this, because I got this version, which is the new Golantz SF Masterworks version, which came out, I think, in 2014 as an e-book. And it has an introduction. I should probably look, actually bring up the table of contents here. So there's two different introductions. There's an introduction by Graham Slight, which I think is the original introduction when this was actually put together in 1990. And then there's another introduction two, by John Clute, which was written in 2014 for this. So it was interesting to kind of get what people were saying about this. It was like, yeah, this was written in 1990, this was published in 1990 as a collection of all of her best stories. But it turns out all of her best stories were published or written and published within like 6 years or 7 years, you know, like a really short span of time. And then her later books weren't, or her later stories, they were just like, yeah, they're not just not good enough. So it was really interesting to see a story collection of the entire short story work of like a whole author. And then they just go, okay, the best of hits, let's just pick those. Because it wasn't her picking them, and it wasn't, you know, it was like we can see the complete span of this. It was like if someone said, okay, let's get all of Asimov's stories and just the best ones, rather than the best ones in this decade or the best ones of this style or just the best robot ones. It's like, no, just the best, you know. So
do you remember when she died?
I think 1986. So that's just okay. because I only went back and read these introductions after I read the whole thing, because
yeah, and my introduction is by Michael Swanwick.
Okay, well, that must be a different... Oh, yeah, actually, it says that's a Tachyon 2004 mm-hmm. collection. So there's different introductions by when this collection has been published. So it was, 1990, 2004, 2005, and then 2014. So there's, a Michael Swanwick introduction, a Graham Slight introduction, and a John Clute introduction in different versions. So I was just talking to Juliana about this today. She's in hospital at the moment with a broken foot after falling off a ladder. No, it's okay, she'll be fine, but she's coming out of hospital tomorrow. But we were just talking, and I was like, I was bringing up like greatest hits of bands, you know, of music, when you go, okay, this is the greatest hits, but it's never really all the greatest. It's not all their best songs, because they'll be, oh well, that was a hit off that album, but it's like, well, none of the songs on that album were as good as like half of the songs on this earlier album, you know. So but what I liked about this was it is really just the greatest hits. It is, and that's why I think this is so strong, is because they were just like, the later stuff wasn't as good, and it just doesn't have to be represented at all. We'll just go with the earlier her earlier works. So
We keep calling James Tiptree her.
Yeah.
So I guess if people don't know, we should say that it's the pen name for Alice Sheldon.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. Probably some people won't know. Actually, that's what Juliana was saying. Why did you say her? And I was like, oh, yeah, it's actually Alice Sheldon decided to start when she first started writing stories when she was like 50 something, you know, in her 50s, she started putting like submitting stories to be published, and she decided to submit them under a male sounding name. Well, yes, a male name. James, I guess. James Jr. So, yes, every time that we call James Tiptree Jr. she, we're meaning Alice Sheldon, the writer behind the pseudonym. Yeah. So, that was kind of how I got into this book. When did you first read this book or this collection? Had you read anything before this collection by James Tiptree Jr., or was this your introduction?
You know, I never had. I would hear about it from people every once in a while, and people who I really respect that kind of read science fiction on the fringes a little bit really recommended her.
Yeah.
And that my first read was that story that we did for SFF Audio, and then I liked it so much, I was like, oh, well, I have to go read
that
the rest
was it.
Of these stories.
So you read it the first time, at the same time as I read it. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
And now I've read the entire book twice since then.
Pretty good.
Once last year, once now.
Yeah.
Well, I think I ended up talking about the whole book once on Reading Envy, but, you know, I couldn't possibly
do
it justice.
That's another reason why I read this book, is because it was after that podcast that we did together, I think. And then you read that and talked about it. It's like, oh, yeah, I got into this. And I was like, oh, I should really do that. And it was sitting there in my Kindle library on my iPad for a long time. And then every time I was like, oh, what have I got to read? Oh, I'll read some more of these short stories, you know. Well, that's cool that we both kind of had the same introduction to this stuff, because that was the same thing with me. I'd always heard about this, and I'm sure I probably have read in other short story collections, because I used to read lots more short stories when I was 20 years ago to 10, you know, 50, you know, there was a period where I would read like all the science fiction I could get in the age of scarcity, when it was like I would go along to my library and I would read every single science fiction book that I could find, because it wasn't a big library. And there wasn't actually a science fiction or fantasy section. It was just all in with fiction. So I'd go through and go all the way along every bookshelf, pulling the book out to see if there was a spaceship or a dragon or an alien or someone with a sword on. And if it had, I'd be like, oh, okay, and I'll take that book. And if I wouldn't, I'd just push it back in. I'd pull it out. Oh, it's just a picture of a woman in a dress with a man standing behind her. I was like, well, that's not my set. Put it back in. Pull it out, you know, and I'd just go all the way through, and I'd start at A and just go all the way through. And then I would find that. And then once I got to the end, get to Z or whatever it was of Z, as you say, and then I'd go back to the start and then just keep going through. And sometimes, you know, I would never know what I'd find, but that was the kind of thing that I'd do in my like small town libraries, just get through every science fiction, or like all the science fiction I could. But then I started having money to buy books and other stuff, so then I would go into secondhand shops, like charity shops and things, and secondhand bookshops, and buy any science fiction book that was in there. Pretty much, I would get, and that meant lots of short story collections. That's when I would read lots more short fiction, because it was just any science fiction that I could find. And so probably back then,
not single author, but like
no, not single author collections. And I think that's why I kind of started getting, I kind of burnt myself out, because in the end, I just didn't like short story collection. Sometimes there'd be a good thematic short story collection. I'd be like, oh, this is about adventure. But those were never really that in fashion. I mean, now they are, because like, oh, we'll have a post-apocalyptic one or a zombie stories one. You know, now it's sort of like that's what you can do. But back then it was just like, yeah, this is this year's best short stories, or this collection of short stories. And
yeah, those are hard for me to get into. I hardly ever read them, except for... who's the guy that does, Jonathan Strahan, his collections of the best science fiction and fantasy, I really like most of the time.
Yeah. But
he just has good taste.
But the reason I'm sharing that is like where I used to read more science fiction, or where I might have read some of these stories that, I just don't know. I can't remember. It's because you'd get to the end of the story and you'd be like, oh, that's the end of that idea and those characters and that author and that kind of style and everything. And then you'd read the next one and your brain would all have to like adjust and readjust and kind of take on a different worldview and take on different characters and take on different themes and different ideas. Now, what's really amazing about this short story collection is that not only is it all one author, so it's not presented chronologically, so it's sort of like the first one was 1969, next one 1977, then back to 72, onward to 73, back to 72 again, forward to 76. You know, we're not just reading through, and none of them are set in the same world, or maybe they are, but you know, none of them are, they're all in different science fictional worlds, but they're arranged in very much a thematic and like a thematic variation, you know. So, for example, the first two songs are the Green Hill. The first two songs. I've been listening to some new albums recently, and when I was thinking about this, I was thinking, yeah, this is put together as an album. You know, it's put together so the stories kind of flow from one to the other. So The Last Flight of Dr. Ayn and The Screwfly Solution are two different science fictional takes on a single idea, which is sort of like the end of humanity by disease.
And then the next one after that is really about the end of humanity
in a different way,
because of aliens.
What's that?
So yeah, it does
solution.
Follow that progression through time.
The Screwfly,
very much.
The Screwfly Solution is, or which one?
And I Awoke and Found Me Here on the Cold Hillside.
Yeah.
There's that quote where, now we've met aliens, we can't screw, and we're about to die trying.
Yeah. But the Screwfly Solution is also an alien thing as well. I know it's a weird thing. I mean, I'm not giving too much away, but it's sort of like there's this, what do they call it? The Sons of Adam. And again, it was a long time ago I read this, but it's the men are getting this crazy thing where they're killing women, and there's a religion that gets attached to it, but it's obviously some disease because it spreads, and it's this weird thing, like it's like, oh, humans are just going to do themselves in because all men are killing women, and it's, I'm not sure if it's meant to be like a hallucination, but it seems at the end of that's actually a it it's created by aliens to get rid of humanity, to leave everything else intact. It's sort of like, yeah, bombs are too messy, yes. And dropping a meteor on us. And it's sort of like, yes, but we'll be... And I'm like, oh, that's so great. And so there's different spins on it. And then there's boundaries of humanity with some... more of that stuff. And then there's the male and female, which are sort of like science, like space stories with, you know, which talk about, you know, the difference, like men and women and feminism and misogyny and, you know, all those different kinds. But then when it goes on to the next one, is it with Delicate Hands Made? Is that, I can't remember which one is that. Is that the one where there was the woman with the face,
the pig nose face,
yeah. And she gets, and that's kind of, but it's weird because that's a different section, Star Songs, but it works. It could have fitted into the previous one, and that's the amazing thing about this connection, that the last story in each collection could be included in that collection or mini, like, mm-hmm. you know, section, or it could be included in the next section. So even though you're reading lots and different short stories, they flow together thematically in a way that I've never experienced in a short story collection before. And that's why I'd give this collection 5 stars, is because it feels like a whole. And it's because it isn't just, okay, here's the latest 12 short stories I've written put together into a book by an author and they have any say in it. It's like, no, it's obviously someone who, you know, who was the editor of this one? I can't remember. Arkham House. Mm. So I don't know. It was published in the edition... and it was the second author's second book published by Arkham House. So whoever the editor was at Arkham House is a genius. Well, maybe not a genius. Maybe it was obviously clear that they were like, oh, these are all my favorites and they all fit together like this and did some swapping around. But yeah, the way that they all fit together and flow from one into the next and the idea from one is sort of like, okay, and now here, written 10 years later by the same order, by the same author, is another take on that idea, slightly different, and then, you know, and the ideas flow together. So that's one of the reasons.
Yeah, and now that I'm looking at the list, because I have all the lists, I can find other ways to group them, and now that can be kind of an obsession. Because you could put The Girl Who Was Plugged In with Delicate Mad Hands, and you could put, oh, and Your Face Is Oh My Sisters, Your Face Is Filled With Light, because those are all about women who are trying to leave the world they're in various ways.
Yeah, so that, the women men don't see is also about women trying to leave the world of men as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's kind of a theme.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say. So what have we talked about? How we read it? And I didn't make any notes for this episode. I thought, well, it's all in my head because it's all fresh.
Just gonna wing it.
And you've just read it. So we've talked about... Do you have anything else to say about the structure? Because those are the two things that I really wanted to say at the start, is sort of like, why this... And you brought it up, like, why would I give this 5 stars, even if individually I don't think they're the best short stories I've read, and I don't think she's the best author I've read, but this collection is one of the best short story collections by a single author I've ever read, or even best short story collection I've ever read, probably.
Well, and I think even the structure within the stories themselves, I mean, I don't like it when every story ends with a twist, or every story, you know, where so you start kind of training yourself to look for that part, as if it's the only important part.
I've talked about that on my podcast many times, is that always it's like the setup and the punchline. Now, what is the twist? What is the punchline going to be in short stories? That's what turns me off about them as well. So
I don't think I see that here. Although there are times where, especially the Screwfly Solution, right? I wasn't expecting the ending that was there. So I guess that in some ways it's a twist, but when it starts to dawn on you, it's like, wow, I really should have seen that coming.
Yeah. But then there's these other twists. And that's why I didn't like about The Girl Who Was Plugged In. It was, I was like, oh, and it's all time travel. And I was like, but it isn't. You know, like, why put that in the end? And that's sort of, that was one that that's probably why I didn't like it, was because it was trying to just go, oh, yeah, and then there's this thing that happens at the end of Red Shirts. Did you read Red Shirts by John Scalzi? And at the end, it's this whole story, and then the end is all right. And then they all got up and they went and then they got into the spaceship, and then it was hit by a rock and they all died. And you're like, ah. And you're just like, but why did... And it's literally like, oh, and then they were hit by a rock and they all died. And it was it's just sort of like a big fuck you to the readers. Like, oh, and actually everything I've written just doesn't matter. And that's what a lot of short stories feel like. It's sort of like, oh, and I've done all of this. Actually, it wasn't that. It was this other thing. And you're like, oh.
Right. You know, wanted to tie it up.
Yeah, I just wanted to tie it up. And it's like, you don't need to leave it. Did you just drop a ruler or something? I didn't.
Sorry.
Don't worry about it. yes, you liked it that the structures there, it wasn't a twist on the end of every single story.
Yeah, they were all kind of structured differently. So I wasn't finding myself in a pattern where I was getting tired of reading, and it was easy to read them back to back.
Yeah.
Because they're so different from each other. Even if the themes are the same, somehow the stories are very different from one another. So I think that's skill.
Well, that's what I was saying about, like, when you're going from one story to the next, it's thematic connections all the way through and an author connection. So like the author's kind of view or voice is always there, but the characters mm-hmm. and writing style changes all the way through, which is why when you get to the girl who was plugged in, it's probably a really good break from what from the previous few stories, and it leads into other stuff that goes on after that. But like in isolation, I think some of these stories aren't as strong, but some of them, they're like some of the short ones, for example, the Her Smoke Rose Up Forever, the title story, I don't think that's great. Look, I read through some. I had a look at some other reviews, and some people said that's probably one of the best stories in here. For me, it was like, it wasn't.
And, I mean, the title's really nice, but
I didn't like it. But
I actually had to look it up to figure out what it was about. I really didn't understand it.
Okay.
Did you understand it? What do you think it's about?
It kind of just explains it in the story, where it's like, okay. If you have someone is like, so they even say, oh, I'm reading this paper by this scientist who says that if you have love in your life and the thing that you're so emotionally attached to, your greatest emotional attachment is something that there'll be a pattern that you'll imprint on the universe, that even after you die, this pattern of your love, of your most, your highest emotional moment will continue on in the quantum patterns forever or something. But it's saying like, yeah, sure, that could be someone that you have a really strong emotional desire for, or whatever your heart's desire is. But what if you're a disgusting person whose biggest emotional moment in their life was in an embarrassing thing where you had to get naked in a lake when you're duck shooting, and then other bad things that happen in his life, and it's sort of like Her Smoke Rose Up Forever. It's sort of like the thing that carries on from his life into the infinity and the quantum bubbling of the universe was his sexual shame, and I can't remember exactly the other things that happened in there, but it's like it won't. For most people, their biggest emotional thing, or not for most people, but for many people, their biggest emotional thing in their life, which will have the biggest impact, which will resonate forever, isn't going to be a positive connection with another human being in a loving relationship. It could be shame and hatred and other things, which is pretty heavy.
Well, I understood that, but by itself, that doesn't seem like a science fiction concept to me. And one of the reviews I was reading said that the whole point of it's that an alien is making this human relive his painful moments.
I didn't pick up on that at all.
And that changes it completely, but I don't know where they get it, because I can't see the alien in there anywhere.
No, there were sometimes, like in the I can't even say James Tripti. I can't even say that. And then some of these, the screw fly solution, the name should have given it me away. Like, should have given it away that, oh, it's actually aliens. But there's others where I wouldn't say, oh, there's aliens. You know, it just doesn't, make sense. We were just mentioning before we started recording this that we were like, yeah, I remember all the stories, but some of the names are so, like, poetically distant from the story itself, is that we couldn't remember which story was which, if you know what I mean. The girl who was plugged in is really obvious.
Yes, we should have a little quiz.
Yeah.
Let's see. A Momentary Taste of Being.
Is that the one with the aliens and they're drinking the tears? No, the wings of the... I don't even remember.
It's not.
Oh, which one's that one? See,
one. Where there's the brother and sister, and they've found this alien planet that they think is going to replace Earth. Yeah. And then in the end, there's something about how they were using humans as sperm to create this other thing.
Oh, yeah. And then it's sort of like, we're just going to be, it's like humans are just jism. We're just pollen that just moves stuff around.
We're used sperm tails.
used sperm tails. Is that quote from the book? I couldn't remember that one. Yeah, something so exactly. Like, so there's some of the, so which one is the one where they where they go, and at the end it's sort of like, oh, they're drinking this drink, and it's made
Stars of Tears.
Is that Stars Tears?
Well, that's what the drink is. Yeah, but it's from We Who Stole the Dream.
Oh, that's okay. So it's in that it's in the Star Songs section. So I was in the right section of the book. Yeah. With Delicate Mad Hands is so
Pig Planet.
Pig Planet one, yeah. The thing is, I read some of these like 5 days ago, and I'm looking at them, and I'm still like, I don't remember which one's slow music. Okay, so
I had to take notes because there's no way I was going to remember everything.
Yeah, I was, and that's what I was doing just when you sent me a message saying, "Hey, I'm ready to start recording." I was like, "Okay, let me." I was actually looking back through some of the ones, and there was this one called "I Have Come Upon This Place by Lost Ways," and I was looking through it, and I was scrolling through it, and I just don't remember anything about that one. So it's not as if all of these stories are great. It's just that like there's obviously some of them where like I read it a month ago, and I'm looking at it, I'm just going, I just don't. But it is a book that I think you have to read in order, or like you say, find your own order once you go through this one. So, do you want to talk about an individual story that really stood out to you? Because we haven't really got into any.
Sure.
And then I also want to talk about this, like the point of view with people saying, the whole written by a woman pretending to be a man thing. Because I've got a few things that I'd like to say about that. Mm-hmm. As well.
Well, it seems like there are so many stories that are about people who go to these other planets looking for things that don't exist.
Yeah.
And I think the best one for that is probably We Who Stole the Dream. And so you have these aliens who I think when they call people Terrans, those are Earth.
Yeah.
Earthlings. Oh, yeah. Humans.
The thing is, this is one of my favorites because it is written from the point of view of non-humans and the humans are the invading aliens, but then there's other aliens, like it's not like the humans are the bad guys, there are other bad guys as well,
and so they think that they figure out that they're still part of their homeland, and so they kind of arrange this whole escape / overthrowing of a cargo ship of some kind so that they can get their babies off. And when they get home, we can do spoilers on here, right? I can't remember.
Yeah, I mean, these are short stories. The enjoyment on all of these isn't about oh, I don't know what's happening at the end of this story, because some of them are so short that like sometimes there's aliens, sometimes there's not. These books aren't about the twist. They aren't about the twist. I don't think it's about the exploration and how one story goes from one to the next. So
And so the aliens are called Joylani, and all this time they've kind of made the Terrans into. Yeah. You know, evil overlords or something. And one of the reasons is because they consume Stars Tears, which are made only when another, I guess, breed of aliens is in incredible pain. And they basically kill and torture a couple in love. And that's the liquid that comes out of them when that happens. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Terrans are bad. They want to leave. And so they do. And they find their people. But their people are all young and militarized, and everyone carries weapons, and they drink Stars Tears.
Yeah.
And it's just so horrible at the end. And
it is one of those stories which I think, oh, this, how many times must this have happened, like in the real world, of like people who escaped and they're slaves, and they're like, let's get out of here, let's get back to our people, and they escape and they get home. And they get back to the home nation, and they're immediately put into chains and sold into slavery again. It's like, no, you know, it's one of those things where you just go, oh, actually, it isn't like the escapism. Like this is a literal escape that they do, but escapism and escape doesn't always take you to a better place. You know, the grass isn't always greener. Although the humans weren't it. That humans drank Star Tears wasn't the only bad thing that the humans were doing, but then it wasn't the only bad thing that the Jolani people were doing either when they got back to with them. So
when you read all the stories together, that's maybe one of the only ones other than A Momentary Taste of Being where it shows the end and the disaster. But then there's these other stories like Slow Music, where they're leaving on the rivers, but you don't get a sense of
story. That was one of my favorites.
I know, but you don't know what happens in the end.
But this is the thing: is what again? I don't want to give this one. This one is one of those ones where I kind of don't want to spoil it. But in a lot of these stories, people just die at the end. Oh, and at the end, everyone dies. Like we talked about with that, with the girl who's plugged in, and you know, the Screwfly solution, of course, and all of these other ones where you just go, and at the end, everyone dies. Or not everyone dies, or death. But like so many of these stories are like about death and about moving on. And this was amazing because it comes right at the end, and they go into the, you know, the humanity is like been reduced, and the people who are left are going into these like rivers, are kind of alien rivers or not alien. You know, you're never quite sure again what's happening with these rivers. But if you went into these rivers, and it's not even a river when you actually get to the river, I was like, where's the river? And it's like a vortex, which
like some kind of quantum thing,
this weird portal, some kind of dimensional travel, but it takes you away and people go in there and they kind of fade away and lose. But when that actually happens at the end, it's like, is this death? And that was amazing. Yeah. It's sort of like, this is all the rest of the time when people die, it's like, yeah, there is no afterlife. You're dead. Like, you're dead, 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 dead. Like, everything up until that point is now nothing because you are now dead. Well done. You're dead. Of course, Her Smoke Rose Up Forever is slightly different in that way, but I guess that's why this is in the life and death section, section six. But yeah, in this slow music at the end, you're like, this could be a happy ending. Like, it's two people in love.
It could be.
There's two people in love and they're just floating up into the air. And maybe they are literally, I can't even remember what, you know, it's difficult to even say what was happening at the end of there, at the end of slow music. But you're like, this could be a happy ending. Maybe. I don't know.
Maybe.
Yeah. So many people die at the end of these books and halfway through and at the beginning, to be honest. It's very much. And then you wonder, like when you read, oh, and then the way she died was a murder suicide when she shot her husband and then herself. And you're like, yep.
Yep.
And you just go, well,
it's in there.
Yeah. When you read these books, you're like, yeah, I could probably imagine somebody writing all of these. And then at the end of their life, or not at the end of the life, not even at the end of the life, just going, yeah, I think I'm done now. And then shooting a husband and then herself. Very strange when she was like, what, 70 or something like that. So, yeah.
Yeah, not that old.
Not that
so
old.
How about you? Does one stick out to you?
Well, slow music is very good. What is the... Oh, again, there was some... was it We Who... the We Who Stole the Dream. We just talked about that one as well. There are some which... The Women Men Don't See, I thought was very, very good.
Yes.
That's one of those ones where you're going, why is this science fiction? Oh, is it time travel? Like, who are these two women? What's their connection? You know, and you get through to them and you're like, ah, okay, that's interesting. I think that's one of the better stories in there as well. The Screwfly solution I really enjoyed. There was others, but...
The Women Men Don't See, can we go back to that one for a second?
Because definitely, I definitely want to talk more about that. Yeah.
There's the mother and daughter, and they're in the plane, and the plane crashes.
And then there's a pilot and the other guy, and the viewpoint.
And it's
character.
Important who the pilot is, because in my second read of that story, I'm realizing, you know, the aliens rescue them from the jungles of Mexico, where the plane has crashed. But, you know, the daughter gets pregnant from the pilot first.
Yes.
And it occurred to me that the mother must have known about this all along. And what other genetic variants because you have than someone who is a pure Mayan.
Yes.
You know, that would be the opposite of your genetics if you're just coming from the north somewhere.
Oh, yes. I noticed that seemed to be very specific. And one of the...
Seemed to be very important.
Yeah. And when... Because I actually just... Literally, because I was just looking at the stories and I actually went to the very first page of this. And let me have a look at this. It says... what is it? There was this the woman and her young companion, a daughter, neatly picking up. So it says, she says, no problem. When the captain asks if I may ride along, the mother says mildly, of course, without looking at me. I think that's when my inner tilt detector sends up its first faint click. How come this woman has already looked me overly carefully enough to accept on her plane? I disregard it. Paranoia hasn't been useful in my business for years. But the habit is hard to break. And I'm like, the reason she dismisses you without looking at you, without even having to look at you, is because you're white like her. And exactly what you're saying, when you're wanting genetic diversity, you don't just go, oh, yes, we're white Americans and here's another white American or whatever it is. You know, it seems to be very clear to me that the whole point of this is that this is the women men don't see. He is a man the women don't see because he is just superfluous to their plan. It's sort of like, oh, yeah, you can come along. It's not going to, nothing's going to happen. Nothing's going to, like, it just doesn't matter that he's along. He's like a sperm tail.
Right, and since
sperm
he
tail.
Refers to them... Yeah, exactly. And he refers to those women as blurs. So he doesn't want to see them either, but he gets upset when they don't see him.
Yeah. And that
there's a lot of men like this in these stories.
Yeah. And this is one of those amazing things. Again, you say, oh, it's really important. I also picked that up on that, like on my first read through, but I didn't pick up on this line until I just looked at it the second time. And it was like, how come this woman has already looked me carefully enough? Like, like literally out the corner of her eye goes, it doesn't matter. That person is just not important because he's white. And yes, that kind of genetic diversity thing is something very important in this story. Oh, yeah, again, as it seems to me that, yes, taking a bit of everywhere to the stars or whatever's happening. Yeah. Anyway, carry on with this one. I just wanted to bring up that little bit for the second
read. Oh, no, that's only really... It's just funny because, you know, I read these all last year, but... I had forgotten about the aliens somehow for this story. Like I didn't remember where
Again,
it was going.
Another one. Another one where you just go, oh, this is science fiction. Ah, okay.
Yeah, they are.
No, I think it's an amazing story because this is one of those things where you just go, oh, this is a story called The Women Men Don't See. And it's told from the point of view of a man who is so uninterested in these women purely because they are women that... Their story is the most important story in the world. Let me put it that way, you know, or maybe not in the world, but it's not like this is one of those first. But they are so unimportant to him that he can't see that there's this really big, important story happening right there, like right in front of him. And he never looks outside of his own, like, male experience. There's the pilot that he identifies with, that he learns the pilot's name, I think. But the women. I guess they don't share their name. They don't share their names. Miss? I can't even remember. I'm just trying to look at the story.
I remember it's now. Ruth in the end, and I don't remember.
Yes, but it's a long
name.
Time. It's just Miss, Mrs. Miss, isn't it? It's sort of like Mrs. this and Miss here. And then there's these other people like the Mexican drug cartel or whatever. You know, there's other things going on, but he never looks past his own male story and male dominated. I mean, of course, it's right there in the title, but it's an amazing piece of writing where, as I was reading through, I was going, this is great. It's like there's this whole other thing going on. Do you remember the movie? There's a movie, Cloverfield, where it's this alien, like this big alien, a monster attacks New York. And it's like, yeah, that's happening, but we're going to follow this little group of people here, and they've just got their own story. And you understand that there's this massive Godzilla movie going on in the background with, you know, we got to save the city, and it's here, and they're tracking it around the city. But the story we get is like a different one, and it feels like and that's this is the opposite of that. It's sort of like there's this massive story happening and we're just following this guy because a man's view in the story. This book is like so much of a massive critique on Ringworld, where it's sort of like, oh, we've got these female characters, and have you read Ringworld? I'm not sure, but there's
the Motis, right?
That's the Mote in God's Eye, of course. No, The Ringworld is by Larry Niven, and there's this story. There's this character, I can't remember her name, like Leela or something. Maybe I'm getting the names mixed up. And she's the luckiest person ever, and it's her story all the way through. And this is what me and Juliana were talking about last time we read it. It's like it's her story, like her. She's the one who's the most important person on the mission, or one of the most important people on the mission. She does it. It's about her. At the end, it's her story is resolved, and that's the thing that resolves the plot and everything. And this is written by a male, and it's a woman's story. But they were like, oh, and we're going to have Louis Wu over here, who is a male, a white, like middle-aged, in the story, he's like 200 years old, but like he's standing in for the middle-aged, white, American male point of view in the story, and he doesn't do anything except go along on this adventure when other people and bigger stories are happening. He's just the observer, and I'm like, why is this guy the main character in the story? Why is he the protagonist? Why is this person the one that we're following when other more important and interesting stories are happening elsewhere, and we just get everything told from the point of view of his, like, disgustingly nasty, misogynistic, sexist point of view? as he goes through this book, and you're just like, oh, okay, this book is the opposite. The women men don't see is like the opposite telling of that story. Oh, well, it's not an opposite.
Yeah.
It's an even more extreme telling of that story within, like, yeah, this is world-changing thing happening, but because we stick with the white, middle-class, middle-aged male, we miss the real story. We miss the interesting story, which is... that's why I think that story is so impressive.
Yeah, and Ruth is pretty direct about it, and he's just not paying attention.
No, he just doesn't get it.
She talks about how women are just like possums.
Yeah.
Where they're everywhere, you just don't notice them.
Yeah.
And so it kind of makes you wonder how many other aliens are coming and picking up women, you know, in the background of this story.
Mm.
Like, what's happening everywhere else? Because I don't think this is probably a single event.
No, that's what I'm getting at. Is like, this is there. The women seem to know that this is going to happen at this time.
Yes.
And
I'm very interested in the world around it.
It can't just be in that one little tiny place in Mexico. I can't remember who wrote it, but there's this story which is like, okay, the aliens, we get a message from aliens, we're going to arrive and we're going to pick up anyone from Earth. And the reason we know that you want to be picked up from Earth and taken with us on this alien ship is that you've got to get within like 100 meters or 100 feet of the sea at this exact time. So anyone on the seashore at exactly that time, within 100 meters of the sea, will be picked up. So that's the only thing that needs to do. And everyone knows that if they want to go with the alien, they stand within 100 meters of the sea or an ocean. And if they don't, they stand back. And that's the way that the book begins. The first chapter is people going down and standing on the seashore and being taken off with the aliens because nobody was quite sure if it was a hoax or not or what was going on, if it was real. And it does. And that's kind of thing that I feel is happening in The Women Men Don't See. It's like there's something happening here which is bigger than just these two women. On this story, you know, in this story. But maybe it isn't. Yeah. Maybe it is just those two women, but because it seems like maybe she was the older woman was obviously part of the intelligence agency, something intelligence, but maybe I was reading that into it, that her story
no,
was...
No, it seemed like it, yeah.
Yeah, which is
like
actually...
she'd been trained to be invisible in some ways,
yes,
too.
Which is interesting because James Tiptree Jr., no, Alice Sheldon, was also part of CIA intelligence history. She had a history of doing intelligence work or being in intelligence circles, let me put it that way. I don't know if she was ever like a field agent or anything, but that definitely feels like there's something in here in this book as well, in The Women Men Don't See. Okay.
Did you ever go back and read her autobiography or her biography that's out there?
Who, Alice Sheldon?
Yeah.
Nope. No.
Because I kind of feel like I'd like to know more about her. I just haven't taken the time, but...
I'm rarely that interested in authors' real lives, in a way.
Hmm.
Some of them I would be interested in, but like I always feel like with authors, I get so much more from their writing about them.
Sure.
Which I certainly feel like with this. And there's actually very few authors, I think. Actually, there's some who I think before they were an author, they probably have a very interesting life, certainly like Alice Sheldon. Actually, she's probably one of the more interesting people because she started writing so late. But so many authors, I think, up until the point you were a professional author, your life sounded pretty interesting. But now you sit in a room and write, you know. And there's quite a few of these authors who are like, yes, he used to work for NASA and this person used to be a physicist. And it's like, wow, your life back then seems really interesting because you're going around the world and doing, you know, someone like Alistair Reynolds, one of my favorite authors. But now he goes, well, you know, I go out into my garden and I take photos of Saturn through my, you know, it's like, well, back when you used to work for the European Space Agency and do imaging and that kind of stuff, it's like, that sounds more interesting because, of course, he puts all of those ideas into his books. And, of course, his books are just way more interesting than his real life, even though I do enjoy being subscribed to his blog and reading along with what he gets up to and some of his nonfiction writing, the stuff that just gets posted on the blogs. And someone like Peter Watts is, I find fascinating because, again, he was a scientist like doing marine biology, and he still seems to keep up with all of the literature, and he puts all of the literature into his science fiction book. So it's like you're kind of overwhelmed with ideas, and then after he publishes his books, those ideas start coming out into the real world. Or, you know, like he actually says on his blog that I read so much that I'm not predicting the future. I'm just getting to the papers. I'm getting to the research and getting to the direction the research is going to before the popular press does. That's all he said. That's my only trick when I'm writing these stories, which seem to predate, like predict where the future is, or like future discoveries in marine biology. So, yeah. So, other stories that you liked or didn't like?
Well, one of them that I find very fascinating is Your Faces, Oh My Sisters, Your Faces Filled with Light. Long title.
Yes.
Which one is this one? So that's the one where the woman is wandering what seems kind of like a post-apocalyptic Chicago.
Wait a second, she's just some kind of messenger. Also one of my favorite stories.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Hey, we're agreeing today. This is interesting.
And this is the weird thing. Sort of like, I'm saying also one of my favorites. It seems like half of them are my favorites. Another quarter of them are okay. And then a quarter of them, like, I didn't even get to this. I just kind of skipped to the end of this one, which I'll get onto one of those in a minute. We'll but yes, anyway, carry on talking about this one, because I found this one fascinating.
It is. And it starts out and you're picturing a landscape kind of like Snow Crash or something like that, where people are wandering around on bikes and making
like
deliveries
kind of thing.
Yeah, and it seems like it's all women. Everyone she greets is a sister, and she's so happy and ebullient. And then you start to realize that there are cars around, and there are men, and there are people who pick up this hitchhiker that was clearly insane. And I was so confused. But then at the end, I think you kind of understand it. But it's just awful. And I guess I still don't really understand what happened to her before this world. But disappointed.
What, at the end of it?
Well, I was disappointed that world didn't exist, I guess.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you just go, when you get to the end of like a TV episode, and it's like, and it was all a dream. You're like, oh, so none of that matters. None of that counts. You're like, oh, why is it? So yeah, I actually made a note of this one. Alternative reality only in one person's head. And it's one of those things that, did you read by Jo Walton, what was the latest book, that won the Hugo and Nebula of hers?
Among Others.
This is one of those books where I was like, Among Others could have been, after reading this short story, Your Faces, Oh My Sisters, Your Faces Filled, too long of a title. But it's one of those things where you go, oh, that would have been an amazing short story. Take out all of the public school stuff and the really boring, you know, take out all of the 14-year-old girl stuff, but, you know, there's loads of stuff in there. I was just like, oh, why are we just reading about books? Yeah. Like, we're not reading about the books that she's read. We're just reading a list of the books we've read. And all I'm getting is a 14-year-old's opinion of what book is, oh, and it was great because this, you know, and it was just so pathetic. Like, I didn't get to the end of it, but it was like, this person has obviously gone through trauma and they're making up something in their brain which makes them feel better about their life. Either in that book, she's making up the fairies, or she's making up the fact that she had a sister that died, or maybe, you know, I don't even know, but it felt like I was just reading about someone who was damaged in a way. The same with life.
It would have been almost better if that had been true.
Yeah, and it's the same with Slaughterhouse 5 and The Life of Pi. You're reading these stuff and it's like, well, obviously this stuff isn't real and it's happening in the person's head and they're living in a delusion, but the delusion is something that's helping them cope and get through the difficult time. In The Life of Pi, he was stranded on a boat and had to pretend that he had a tiger with him, or that he had to pretend that he was the tiger. You know, that's the whole point of that book, is that it was his belief that he was believing that he was going through this experience and had a tiger, he had to become the tiger to get through that. He had become the tiger to kill the other people on the boat with him. Mild spoilers for Life of Pi, but I mean, it was kind of giving it. But again, with Slaughterhouse 5, you know, was it Billy Pilgrim? No, what's the name of the guy? Someone Pilgrim. He had to pretend that he was traveling through time, or that he had gone off to in a spaceship and had been abducted by aliens. That was his coping mechanism, you know. The fantasy world where he was a religious leader in the future, a cult leader, and everyone loved him, is a fantasy that he was getting through massive post-traumatic stress. And done well in a book like Life of Pi or like Slaughterhouse 5, that's, I think, really impressive and really interesting, was Among Others didn't have that. Mm-hmm. Whereas Your Faces, Oh My Sisters, Your Faces Filled with Life did have it in a way which was, but we were seeing it from both sides. You know, it wasn't like, oh, this is not reality, and it becomes magic like The Life of Pi, or it becomes science fiction like Slaughterhouse 5. It's sort of like, actually, we're getting both sides here. And that's why I found it so interesting, that we're having that post-traumatic stress, mentally ill, I guess, delusional person's view. But then we're also getting the other side, when people are meeting this person and going, hey, there's no tiger in a boat. It's just a boat with a crazy guy who's obviously killed people and eaten them, you know. So, yes, it's a strange one.
Well, and in this case, the only thing we really know about her is that she's had a child that she doesn't acknowledge. And so it could be, what do you call it? Postpartum depression, I guess. But
yeah,
that seems like a bit of a stretch for the world that she's created in her head.
Yeah, it's like, and it must have been really traumatic to get to want to live in female only Mad Max kind of thing is pretty impressive.
Yeah. Well, and at the end, did you get that she's raped? Because those aren't dogs that are attacking her. She just doesn't have any capacity to understand that they're men.
She can't see men. This is why it's amazing that this is coming straight after the Women Men Don't See, 1973.
Yes.
Your Faces, Oh My Sisters, Your Faces Filled With Light, too long a title, 1976, is the same, but literally the men women can't see, or the men this person can't see. Yeah, so at the end...
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
The end. I'd actually forgotten the end, but obviously at the time it affected me a lot because, like I say, this is one of those amazing books. Yeah. An animal, one of the poor dogs, she thinks, following her. Oh, well, they must do it all... They must do it all right in here with rats. And, you know, it's one of those things that you just go, yeah, and then it switches across to the other person, you know, from the other point of view, sort of saying what's going on. It's an amazing story.
It is. Have you ever read The City and the City by China Mieville?
Yes, I have.
So I thought about that too.
I was just thinking about that.
The multiple worlds, yeah.
I was just thinking about that as well, because I'd at the same... After I read this, I read The Dying Earth, which I will probably review next week on the Science Fiction Book Review podcast. And in there, they actually go to they go to a city with the greys and the greens. And people who were wearing grey can't see anyone who's wearing green. And the people who are wearing green can't see anyone who's wearing grey. And they don't acknowledge each other until someone wears red. And then when they wear red, they're kind of like deciding that they're going to become a rebel or a ranger. I can't remember, or a pirate or whatever it is. And they're going to go and take over the other... So we're going to go and steal something from over here. But because they're wearing red, everyone can see someone who's wearing red. But it also means that if someone's wearing red, you have to attack them. So then they get it from both sides. So people who live there and wear red and are always attacked from both sides. So they, you know, it's one of those kind of things where as soon as you can start seeing the other people, like, okay, I'm going to put on red because I'm now going to show that I'm apart from everyone, and then you get killed. And it's the same kind of thing. It's sort of like the people over here can't see that thing, and the other, you know. So, yes, City in the City is, again, one of those amazing premises which came into kind of a very average book in the end. I was hoping for more from that premise.
It ends up just kind of like a crime novel.
Yeah. And again, told from the point of view, that's another book where the story is actually happening to a young female student, I think she is, that she's like the person who died or was killed for some reason, but we don't see it from the interesting point of view of the person who's actually discovering things and is going through a life-changing experience as a student visitor to the city, or someone who's, you know, experiencing it for the first time. Instead, we get it from the point of view of the male middle-aged white guy.
Yeah,
yet again the interest in there, the real story was the story that the white male detective was investigating. And all he was doing was uncovering things that the young female character who had died had already uncovered. And I'm like, why are we just reading this secondhand through the point of view of an old white guy or a middle-aged white guy? Why can't we just get the original story told from the female's point of view? But we don't.
Could have flipped it around and it would have been a lot more interesting.
The thing is, it wouldn't have even been flipped around. The actual story, like if you were telling if you weren't telling the plot of the book, you're actually telling the story of actually what happened. It was, we had this woman, the young female student who came to the city, discovered all this thing about the city and the other city, and discovered too much, and she died. Okay. And then after she died, a white guy, middle-aged white guy, came along and retraced her footsteps and discovered what she did, and then shot some people and then got to the end. And you're like, well, why are we starting only when the male main character gets involved? And it's just, it annoys me.
Yeah.
It annoys me. Mm-hmm. I mean, when it comes to not telling the story from the point of view of the female character, we're actually, you know, we're getting it from the male, but just when that happens otherwise. It's like, why am I just reading about somebody being told about something else, like in Snow Crash? It's like, why are we just getting someone doing stuff and then he's just being told a lot of stuff by a librarian, and then later on he then recounts it to somebody else? It's like, well, why Why aren't we reading about the woman who discovered all of this and gave... There, again, it is. It's, again, a woman gave him this information on the library. She was... Fucking hell, why is it always happening like that? I don't know.
It's a conspiracy.
It's a conspiracy. Why is it the women do all the discovering and then they hand over their discoveries over to a man and then we get the main novel from the man's point of view?
I guess we're just going to have to clone ourselves and stop letting the male chromosome live. And...
Okay. We are veering on quite a lot onto gender stuff and feminism stuff. So let's talk a bit about that. What do you have to say about this thing? I said we'll get onto this because it is written by a female writing as a man, and many of these stories are then written from a man's point of view. So we've got like these three different, or it's written as a woman writing as a man, then writing from the point of view of a female. So we've got like this, like always there's like three or four different levels of gender identity going on with these stories. So
yeah, and you know, what I wish more than anything is I wish I could read it in the context of the era it was written, you know, where like abortion had just been passed and not even passed in the United States for most of these stories. So, you know, thinking about women's like reproductive rights in that era and then not knowing that she was a woman, I just really wish I could know what that was like and what people thought of the stories from that perspective, because clearly a lot of people thought that James Tiptree Jr. was one of the best writers of that decade, you know?
Yeah.
And they were shocked. I want to know, like, what is it that that made them think that? I mean, the writing is beautiful, obviously, but there's so much about gender here. And is it only if you know it's a woman that you see it as feminist?
I can't because believe some of that. I don't know. I mean, but again, maybe if I was, what's this thing to say? A science fiction career, there was this, thing that said Robert Silverberg, he said that he says Harlan Ellison, it was not Robert Silverberg, that was another one. Harlan Ellison introduced Tiptree's story in an anthology, Again Dangerous Visions, with the opinion that Kate Wilhelm is a woman to beat this year, but Tiptree is the man to beat, you know. So like, again, all of these opinions I've reading about what it was like to be going through that time and presuming that James Tiptree Jr. was a male, and then discovering it was a female, all of the thing, everything that I've ever read about any of that has come from the point of view of middle-aged to now old men looking back at that. I've never read anything.
How many women back then read science fiction? I mean, I genuinely don't know. Jo Walton might be someone to ask because she was alive back then reading, right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe I should maybe look at, but it is one of those things that like every time I've ever read about this, it hasn't interested me, like this whole story. I'd heard about it so many times. Oh, she used to write as a male's man's name and the people thought she was men and then didn't. And all of that kind of situation just never appealed to me. Maybe because it felt like a gimmick. Well, not a gimmick, but like the whole, I don't know, it's difficult for me to say, but it felt gimmicky. Not that she had done that, but that's the thing that she was known for. Does that make sense?
Right.
Like, she was known for writing under a male pseudonym and then being discovered. And I'd never, until I read this short story collection, I'd never been really exposed to actually the reason why this was a massive story was because her short stories were just this good. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, nobody ever... I'd never really read about it. The reason why it was such a big deal is because of this material, if that makes sense.
Well, and because it changes what you assume the author is trying to do with the gender topics, I think.
But because I can't see anything else except what's obviously there now, knowing it's written. That's exactly what you're saying, isn't it?
I'm having a hard time, too. And I was reading this one review that says... because she's always known that she's a woman when she was reading the stories, something about, you know, she always reads everything as ironic and wry and, you know, she can't take that part of it out of there. She can't stop it from being sarcastic slightly, you know?
Yeah.
And I wonder too, like, what would it have been like not to know? I don't know. I can't put myself there because I've always known.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it's because when all of that was going down, I was like, 6 years old. She died when I was 6 years old. So yeah, this is all happening well before I was born, let me put it that way. So yeah, yeah,
I'm not even sure when it happened.
Well, she,
like when it became uncovered.
It was 76, 77 or something like that. I've actually just got the Wikipedia page right open in front of me
so
here.
After all these stories had come out.
No, after most of them. There are a few here from like 1978. Slow Music, which is, I said was one of my favorites, is actually from 1980. And that's the amazing thing, that some of these were actually written quite a bit before they were published, up to a few years, up to like 3 or 4 years before they were published. That was talking about in the introductions that I read of this book.
You know, the other one out that comes out after that is with Delicate Mad Hands. So that's really interesting because that one, it starts out and you kind of think it's going to be a revenge fantasy story.
It kind of is a little bit in the middle.
It is in the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then the ending, it takes a very strange turn to me. It wasn't what I was expecting.
I was kind of dissatisfied with that because it felt like... And there's another one as well, Houston, Do You Read? That started off. Those are two stories which both of them I was like, this is really great. And then it got to the end. I was like,
yeah.
Not really doing it for
me. The Houston one, it was such a powerful time travel conundrum.
Yeah.
You know, like how awful that would be. And then it becomes about... aggressive men and cloning to get away from them.
But
and,
it didn't feel real at the end. It felt like a caricature of men. And it was like a forced character. Like, it's like, yes, it's sort of like we are forcing you to be caricatures of yourself by feeding you these drugs which make you over-the-top testosterone and male aggressiveness. And it's like that... It felt like I could identify with these men at the start by their like total quandary that they didn't even realize that they were talking, that there was only women on the other ship. You know, that whole thing was really interesting. At the end, it kind of was, it was like just rammed so far down my throat. I was like, actually, that was a little bit too far down my throat.
Yeah, and I don't even know if the science can work in the end because, well, I guess I just don't know for sure. No. But I was like, I don't know.
I don't know. So, yes, anyway, carry on with your... you were saying, with the Delicate Mad Hands, you're saying that was written after...
It was written after people knew she was a woman. So it's just interesting because she kind of plays with the readers then, doesn't she, a little bit with this idea of a revenge fantasy. Okay, now that you know I'm a woman, let's take this woman who people make fun of her whole life and let's make it true that she's hearing a call from a distant planet.
Yeah. This is what I thought was really interesting. Yeah, the pig planet. It was like
it's not that she's insane, like in that other story. It's actually true. She is here.
That's the thing. It comes back to one of those things that she is obviously like.
I don't know.
She's after you do this crazy thing and you kill everyone. What do you do? Do you just go and land on a planet which has got radiation that gets into your brain and then you have like these weird imaginings and you imagine like is everything that happens after she lands just her going crazier and crazier and crazier and then her killing herself at the end? I'm kind of leaning that way, but then at the end I'm like, but no, it's presented as true, you know. That one is one of those weird ones where the author, unlike in The Life of Pi or unlike in Slaughterhouse-5, the author isn't winking at you. It isn't going, well, we all know that this is actually just a stand-in for this. And there isn't that moment where, you know, like in Slaughterhouse-5, where you actually see Billy Pilgrim pick up the book and go, this is a book about someone being abducted by aliens and going off and having sex with this woman. And then he puts the book down, and then you're like, that was the turning point in that story. You know, that moment is, like, everything that happened before then is real. Everything that happened after that is just a delusion. In this book, there isn't a moment like that. I mean, with Delicate Mad Hands, there isn't that moment. You know, there isn't a winking moment where we're like, aha, and now this is the key to when the madness begins. You know?
I know. And I thought she was going to have this triumphant moment, right? Yeah. And even the person who's been calling her all this way, or this alien, I guess, he's kind of on the outs in his own society.
Yeah, it's
he's
the opposite
ostracized
of him.
Too.
I was so disappointed.
I wanted her to find a planet of people just like her where she'd be accepted and loved and warm. And I mean, she found that from one person. From one alien.
Yeah. Oh, you're saying this is her, like, oh, I was always ostracized I would have been ostracized as a reader and ostracized as a writer of science fiction. And then I was like, oh, actually, I'm coming and I'm like you, but actually, I'm still on the outside. I still have to live in this little cocoon of this spaceship. And if I go outside of my little comfort zone here, am I just going to be killed? And there's maybe one person who understands her or not. So you're saying that's like a science fictional. I never read it as that, but yeah, that could be a science fictional retelling of Alice Sheldon pretending to be James Tiptree Jr. for so long, and then in the end going, ah, fuck you guys, but not finding happiness. I don't know. And then shooting her husband and herself.
I think you could argue it.
Maybe.
I never really even thought about it until I realized that it was published after people knew she was a woman.
Ah, so but just now literally that I know that, in the course like, of this podcast. We're
literally, we're yep.
Okay, that's cool. That's cool. So I want to talk a bit about how some old white male authors, or middle-aged white male authors, said that she was writing in a very, like, she understood men, or because she wrote, there's lots of sex in this book, you know. And also, I just read this review as well, not just now, but beforehand, when I first finished this a few days ago, I read this review, Adam Roberts. You know Adam Roberts, people? I've never read his fiction, I've only ever read his criticism, and often quite enjoy it.
What does he write? He sounds familiar.
Adam Roberts.
Like is he a superhero guy?
No, Adam Roberts. No, he writes science fiction and reviews and critiques science fiction, like on Strange Horizons. Oh, okay. And I've read him on other books as well. I mean, and on other blogs too. And I just read his review, and it's an interesting review, and he says this, but and it keeps coming up where people say, like, Robert Silverberg, in his now notorious introduction to Warm Worlds and Otherwise, declared Tiptree Style to be ineluctably masculine. You know, a deliberately pared down, unsentimental sort of writing, something analogous to Hemingway, lean, muscular, supple, relying heavily on dialogue broken by bursts of exposition. You know, and it's sort of like he disagrees with that in a way, but the idea of it being like masculine, her writing being masculine because it's about sex, you know, there's a lot of sex in this thing, and he actually goes through and, Adam Roberts brings out, talking about, like, bringing out some different examples of her and her language writing about sex and saying, oh, actually, this is how a woman said. But then he talks about, like, her supposed masculinity, sort of like the way that all that men want is sex. And it's not that women also don't also want sex, but like that everything that she comes to in a way of talking about male is sex. And I was not quite sure about that. Do you have an opinion about that? Sort of like the actual, like the sexual contents of, like, is it because she was writing about sex? It's not so much even the gender, but people didn't see the gender issues and the feminism. They saw, this has sex in it, so it must be from a man's point of view.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but I can see that she has a clear understanding. I would almost call it more of an American sensibility than a male masculine. Like this idea of expansion and conquering. And I mean, in some of the time it's gendered, but some of the time it's just about, you know, exploring space and just assuming that you would have the power in that situation. It's all about power. Like even in the one with the Mexican plane crash.
Yeah.
I can't remember these titles.
The women, men don't see.
The women, men don't see. The man is obviously thinking, because he's laying next to the woman and he's thinking about, well, maybe he could have sex with her if it was dark outside and he could forget that she was old. I mean, he's clearly thinking about that all of the time. But I don't know. But I think a lot of women assume men think that way. So
yeah, but this is the thing that I found disgusting as I was reading this book, not that it was being written by a female or anything. No, let me go back a step. Okay, so there's a certain amount of comfort that James Tiptree Jr. has, Alice Sheldon, has writing about the physicality of men and men's bodies in this book. In a way, let me put it this way. So there's these times when, like, just an example, I can't remember if this is actually in the story or if I just make this example up in my head, but like it's in this Her Smoke Rose Up Forever, and it's about talking about this young boy who's getting into this water and about how the water, you know, goes up into his armpits and goes around his scrotum and up his anus and stuff like this. And it's talking about, like, describing the experience of being a man going into cold water in a way which all men, and I think this is why the people say that she writes men really well, is because it does actually feel very real. But weirdly enough, it's something that I've never really read before in fiction, like, so clearly. I think mainly because it's written from the point of, it's written by a woman who is kind of going, okay, this is an otherness I need to capture. What would it be like to have a scrotum and go into cold water? And she writes it really well in a way which is so well that it kind of makes someone go, yes, that is that is what it would be. You know, do you understand what I'm saying there?
Like, I do. But, you know, we expect male writers to be able to write women all the time, right?
They so don't. It's like, well, it's again, endless, I don't know they do.
It's the endless debate. How much do you have of an experience to be able to write about it? That's the question.
But this is the but the point is, what we have in this book is somebody who is female, but is because they are, she's like trying on a male body. She's writing about it in a way which she presumes it would be, it would feel exactly like this to be a man in a man's body, to be like physically a man while going into cold water. And she gets it like really, she, if not totally spot on, but it really evocative. You know, it's very evocative because it feels so real and so physical, and that's embodied in a man's. And I was like, yeah, I'm right there along with that. And I understand how other men would be able to identify. But what got really, really nasty in this book, or really disgusting, which I kept on thinking, there is something rotten in this place, and this place being 1970s male-dominated science fiction, is that all of the men are nasty, like misogynist. I mean, that is of course what a lot of these books are about, but they're just so disgustingly, like, that everyone is, every man is just a rapist, or like in the Screwfly solution, a murderer, but a very specific, we're only murdering females murderer, rapists and murderers. And there's this bit as well where I can't remember which story it is, where there's a guy and he's got like a 16-year-old daughter who's walking around naked and he's like, oh, I really want to fuck my daughter. Oh, but we had this talk about incest and we've agreed that we're not going to do the incest thing. And it's like, oh, like every single time, and there are these people and there's like, oh, this person probably fucks his sister. Oh, yeah, that probably does. You know, and all of these, like, story after story is about these men being just disgusting, like, so, like, any kind of breakdown in society, I'm just going to murder and rape people. I'm going to rape women. And then there's these aliens. Oh, I'm just going to fuck those aliens. And then in another story, I'm just going to fuck those aliens. You know, we still do it. It's just like, oh, yeah, there's an alien there who's kind of like slightly shaped. I'm just going to fuck. Again, everything is like, oh, I'm just going to fuck my daughter and my wife and this woman who I'm just ignoring, but fuck it, I'm just going to fuck. And it's all of this stuff going on. And I don't identify with that, and I don't think that's just me like going, oh no, I'm a nice guy, really. No, it's not. That's just not me. I didn't see myself in any of these men, like any, like a few people. There are a few times when I'm like, oh yeah, okay, I can see this guy, you know. And this is why I think slow music was so amazing for me, is because it's in a time when guys can't give it up, and it's actually a real struggle for him to have sex. Mm. They have to take pills and do all of this kind of thing. It's a real struggle. And I'm like, this guy I can identify with because he can't get it up. And the women men don't see, like, he's just laying there. It's like, oh, but this guy, this woman over here, she's going to, why can't, like, I'm just, like, every single woman, every single female entity in this book is either a target for, like, male sexual aggressiveness or rape, or in something like with Delicate Mad Hands, not like that. She stands out because she isn't that, and people don't want to fuck her, but then people do want to fuck her anyway. And it's just like all the time, and I don't see that. So when I'm reading about people like Robert Silverberg and these other people going, oh yeah, she writes males really well, I'm like, who, what males do you know which makes you think that this is the thing that male men think all the time? And I can now, when I'm looking at this, I can see it when I read Ringworld, where Louis Wu goes, oh, there was a spaceship and there was 90 guys and 4 women's. Well, I bet I can guess what the women's jobs were. And I'm like, ugh, Larry Niven is like, all he sees when he sees females is just like potential rape objects as soon as, like, all he's looking for is like a slight breakdown in society, and then like all women are just targets of fucking. And it's really, it kind of made me angry reading this, thinking that male science fiction writers would identify with the male point of view, again, without knowing that this was being written from a female critiquing this exact point of view. Does that make sense?
And it does. It's like...
Yeah. Sorry, carry on.
Well, no, sorry. So all these men are reading these stories and
who are they identifying with? That's what I want to know.
Well, they're feeling like Tiptree understands what they would have if they lived in the world in the future where they had even more power.
I can't see it.
I mean, think about all the stories in here where there are these intelligent, brilliant, genius women. They've trained as physicists and geneticists, and the only way they can get to space is if they agree to sleep with all the men on the crew.
Yeah.
Because that's actually their function. Their scientific knowledge isn't their function. I mean, that really stuck out to me because of how often it happens in these stories. Mm. Yeah, and
but,
so,
but then the next step along the way, that like this was my revelation as I was reading this book, going like, oh, all of the like the Larry Niven, that kind of generation of writers who now when I was like 13, I read their books. It's not that I was identifying with the male heroes in there. It was just going straight over my head. And then I was like, wait a second. And now when I read them, I'm just like, ugh. And then I read this, I'm like, they thought that was a good thing. Like, and they.
Yeah.
And when someone was writing a critique of that, they thought they were on the other side of the critique. You know, it's like one of those things where like someone makes a movie which is obvious satire, and then the people that they're satirizing going, yes, I agree with this. It's like, no, go back one. No, when you're not meant to.
It just proves the point.
It proves the point. And then, of course, I had this, when I was reading this through this, I had this massive revelation. I was like, oh, this is what it's like to be a female science fiction reader in the 1960s and 1970s, and maybe even now. Again, it's one of those weird things. Again,
and now
when you're reading stuff and I'm just like, oh, like, and people complain, oh, when they describe a man, they describe his height and then describe what he thinks like, and then when they describe a woman, they spend three paragraphs talking about her eye color and stuff. And I was like, yeah, like, why is it that why is it that there's And it was one of those things that I was like, oh, shit. Of course, it's one of those things that I can't. It was only brought home to me just how disgustingly vile, like, living in a male-dominated, misogynistic world is, especially in, like, science fiction. It was only brought home to me by somebody who is female, writing as a male, describing the male's point of view, me going, ugh, and then looking back and seeing other people like, oh, yeah, that's what I feel like. And I'm just like, what? You want to fuck your 16-year-old daughter? And I'm just like, that's not... Wait, go back. Anyway, so it was, for me, one of those real learning moments where I was just... When I was reading it through, I was like, oh, this is what they're saying, that she captures the male experience so well, and because that's not my experience at all. And I don't know, it's one of those things that, like, I guess I'm not always the best feminist, but, like, I think sometimes I'm not the best feminist just because I don't realize just how disgusting most men are, because I don't feel that way myself. You know,
yeah.
Like, I don't watch porn, you know, because, like, I don't know, it's one of those things that I'm just like, this just isn't for me. And I love sex, you know, it's not like I'm not into sex, and that's the thing, it's a totally different thing. Like, it was a weird learning experience. So I would suggest any male read this book and then go back and read anything by Larry Niven, and not just have the same degree as disgust going in, because what Alice Sheldon did is put that all that rapist kind of rape culture nastiness that's in the background in those early science fiction novels and just brought it all up to the surface in a way which even then didn't get through to the authors of the time, which is I find fascinating. Anyway,
yeah, and you know, it really puts the stuff that's happened this year into more of a perspective, I think, because there's been so much discussion in the science fiction community about diversity and a lot of pushback still, even now, 21st century, of people who just don't want to see female characters. They don't want to see minority characters. They don't want to read them or give them any weight. And it's just like, you know, are we really still here?
Yeah.
Do you forget the lessons of James Tiptree?
Yeah. Well, that's kind of the annoying thing, that, like, I hadn't read this until now, but in a way, if I'd have read this when this book first came out in 1991 or something like that, 1990, I'd have been 10 years old. None of this would have happened. None of this would have got through to me. And if I'd have read it when I was 18, probably wouldn't. Yeah. I think it's only maybe in the last like 10 years when I could have read this and had this realization. But then again, it might just be after like this, starting this podcast and getting like reading it and like reading more of other kind, and actually, yeah, having like a greater awareness of this kind of thing, this scene, and then going and really doing this deep dive into this one author, even though it's not even a deep dive, it's one story collection, but it is one of those things where, like, yeah, I think it is very timely to read this book and just realize, yeah, like you get it from the other point of view on both sides. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
Women who read this could get one thing, and then men who read it could who could get another. But then women pretending to be men reading this could get like a third thing out of it. And that's, I mean, that's, I'm not saying like, yeah, trans people or anything like that. I'm saying that like, you put yourself in, put yourself into the other gender and then read this book. And then read it as your own gender, or, you know, read it as your own gender, and then put yourself into the other gender and read it. And you just get, I know, that's the depth of this short story collection, which, again, I've never read anything quite like it. Certainly not as a short story collection. And I mm-hmm. think very few novels could do this, because this is, like, say, this is, 1969 to 1980? That's, oh yeah, so it's like 11 years, but like a lot of these stories are from like 72 to 76. You know, they're sort of like those years yes. are the core years. Oh, it's 1981. Yeah, so 12 years. Yeah. Okay, let's. Should we do some final thoughts? Have you got anything else? Because that was my big thing that I kind of wanted to get out, and why I wanted to do a full podcast about this. Just, you know, some of these big issues that I've talked about, but.
Can we talk a little bit about the stories we didn't connect with so much?
Yeah, sure.
Maybe.
Yeah, go for it.
Because there's a few here where I like, you know.
Yeah, you do it.
I think the first one for me was The Man Who Walked Home, the man that gets caught in time travel anomaly.
Yeah, and he experiences 1 second or one eye blink every year or something, isn't it? So
yeah. I just didn't care about him.
Oh, okay. I thought that was quite interesting. I thought it was quite fun. But it did feel like a one-premise writing exercise rather than a story.
It was like an idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Love is the Plan, the Plan is Death. It's monkeys, right? Okay, get it. Move on, you know.
To be honest, this is the only...
I don't think I finished it.
This is the only story I didn't finish. I started it and I was like, this is not really for me. And then I carried on. I was like, this is really not for me. Like, I never thought that was a story I was going to enjoy. But it does have a Wikipedia page. So I could just, it says, Mogadeet is a spider-like creature who has decided that since he's intelligent, he will resist the instincts which lead to his species through an exceptionally violent life cycles, including a drop in intelligence during winter. And that's it. So as the years go by, he gradually realizes that the winters are becoming longer and longer, and it's more difficult for him to resist becoming an unintelligent animal. In the summer, he captures and stockpiles prey for himself and his mate to eat during the winter. But when the food runs out, his mate eats him. And I'm like, that's pretty much all I need to know about that. I'm really glad that I didn't read that story. So I'm with you on that one. That one was passing me by, like, from page one. And it was quite long as well. When I was skipping forward, I was like, how much is this to go? And I skipped, and I kept on skipping. And I thought, well, what I'll do once I find out how long it is and I know how much I've got to read, I'll go back and read it. But I kept on going and going and going. And I got to the end. And I was like, next story.
And I don't usually like stories from the point of view of animals anyway. It's kind of annoying.
Is it an animal or an alien? I was never quite sure.
I don't know.
Is it a spider? Is it a... like, you thought it was a monkey? I thought it was a spider or something.
Yeah, you could put any animal name in there and it wouldn't have made a difference. That's the thing. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
The only other one where I would change my mind on that is On the Last Afternoon. Do you remember this? They're on this alien planet and there's these destructive mating sea creatures and this plant... may not be a plant that the man keeps talking to. This is the one where he's in the society where they decided they shouldn't rape their daughters. You mentioned that earlier.
Yeah, I don't.
But basically, the sea creatures are going to come.
Oh no! The thing is, I actually quite like that story. But again, it is in the end, everyone dies. You know, it did feel like it's in the life and death cycle. It was a bit too much. I felt like I'd read that story better by other people before. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Like, there was nothing new in that story. It was okay, but it was like, it felt like an okay retelling of something, of stories that I read before and I already have. Like, oh, we're living on this place. Oh, and there's this weird, mysterious, we're safe here, aren't we? Yeah, we're safe here. Oh, until the aliens come in their mating cycle or in their migration. You know, I've read that in so many. Oh, we're going to set up a new colony. I've even written that story myself. I've actually written a story called The Monster Story. Working title, various versions of this story, and it's not the same thing, but it is like, oh yes, we're colonists, we're living here, all peaceful. Oh shit, monsters turn up, and it felt like just another one of those which I've read before.
Yeah. Well, and I think what would have made that one really interesting is if instead of the human's point of view, it had been from the sea creature aliens and the plant alien.
The plant alien's point of view. I think being it from the plant alien's point of view, that would have been it. Because I don't think I don't think the sea creatures had much impact except for being, monster, like standard, like they are just the monster. Sure. It's not about that. So
they're just big and destructive on accident. They're just preoccupied.
Yeah, they're like, I was just thinking, they're like, you know, when you see walruses on these elephant seals and they come ashore, you know, and they you can't see the beach anymore just because there's so many of them, and they're like battling each other up and down. You're like, yeah, just imagine you were a crab on that beach. You probably wouldn't do very well.
Yeah, those are the only three I think that I just didn't really connect with.
Also, Her Smoke Rose Up Forever, that was one of, for me, that didn't do it. And again, some
it's
of them...
It's a great title.
Yeah, there were some of them which I didn't... Again, I couldn't remember. I think there's some of them were just really amazing, but some of them started off really well, like Houston, Do You Read?
Right.
And then by the end of it, I was just like, this isn't great, actually. And some of them were just a bit too long, like with Delicate Mad Hands. Like, that started off, and when I thought that, oh, she's killed everyone and she's escaping by the spaceship. And I was like, great, okay. And then one thing's going to happen and it's going to be the end of the book. But then it just carried on and carried on and carried on. And then there was a whole other thing, and they were building roads and this group of aliens turned and this. And I was just like, okay, this is too much, too. This is too much.
So,
I don't think there's... I don't have anything else to say.
No, the other thing I will say is just this quote from one of the stories, because I think it's beautiful. It's deep.
Let's read with an ending. Let's end with a reading. Okay. Read with an ending? End with a reading.
It's just two sentences. Man, it's deep. Some cargo cult of the soul. We're built to dream outwards.
What story is that from?
And I Awoke and Found Me Here on the Cold Hills Side.
Oh, okay. And again, now I've got to look that up, which to see which one that is. Oh yes, okay, yeah. Weirdly enough, that's something that I totally agree with Adam Roberts' review about there. So you should. I might put a link into Adam Roberts' review on Strange Horizons. Which,
yeah, I'd like to see that.
It's an interesting thing. He actually says, yeah, it'd actually be better if men were more interested in looking outwards and having sex with aliens, but we're not. We actually just want exactly the same thing every time. And I'm like, yeah, I can pretty much see that. And he was saying, this is something that I disagree with James Tripchi Jr. with. It's sort of like, actually, men aren't interested in new experiences, new women, and new sexual experiences. Sort of like, if you're going to cheat on your wife, you'll probably cheat on your wife with someone who looks exactly like your wife. And I'm like, yeah, that's probably more it's probably more true. But yes, the great quote, but it's funny that that's the exact quote that Adam Roberts has an issue with. Yeah, it's like the whole second half of his review of this is pretty much about that one quote. Yeah. I'll finish with somebody else. This is Adam Roberts. It may be that James Tiptree, or the actual breathing Alice Sheldon, was a more interesting human being than the vanilla hetero male. I'd say that's pretty likely. She certainly wrote more interesting and more brilliantly framed stories than almost anybody. I'm not sure I know what the answers are, but Tiptree, like all great artists, poses vital questions. And I think that's true. What she was actually way more interesting than the typical white male middle-aged scientist protagonist of a story. And
Absolutely.
That's why, because she was so much more, when she was writing about this, it was everything that she wrote was kind of a critique of that position rather than a wish fulfillment of that, or I don't know what you say, pandering to the fans, who of course in this time were all white middle-aged or young white or white middle-aged men probably. So yes, it's mm-hmm. an interesting view. So let's wrap it up. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burge. I'm Jenny. You are Reading Envy on Twitter. Is that the way it works?
That's right. And readingenvy.com.
Readingenvy.com, sfbrp.com. You can check out me on goodreads.com. There's an SFBRP listener group, so become my friend and join in with the SFBRP listener group as well. And you can discuss this book there or anywhere, I'm sure. Jenny, are you on Goodreads as well?
I'm also on Goodreads, just as myself. Please be my friend.
As Jenny...
Colvin.
Jenny Colvin. Mm-hmm. I have it here, but I wanted you to say it. Jenny Colvin. You're not reading Envy on there, are you? So, keep listening. If you've never listened to Science Fiction Book Review Podcast, this is what it's like, except sometimes it's just me, and sometimes it's me with Juliana, my girlfriend, and sometimes it's me with other people. But generally, half the episodes are just me talking about stuff like this.
Yeah, it's great.
Novels. And yeah, Jenny's podcast is like this, but normally about one... Well, not about one story. It's not normally about one story. It's normally about, like, everyone comes with one book or three books, and they talk through what you've been reading recently. So I just listened to the episode with you and Jesse, which was quite fun, although it was very much like a... It did feel like an SFF audio podcast episode.
Because, I couldn't figure out a way to make it any shorter.
Yeah. Oh, well, you could have cut out all of Jesse reading from a textbook about... Lovecraft. I could have done without that. I must admit I did skip forward at that part of the podcast, but the rest of it was good. Anyway, yeah, so check out our opposite podcasts. That's really good.
Yes, please.
And
thank you for having me.
No, it's been really good. Thank you for having me on your podcast here. We'll put your piano music on the front, and I'll put my little science fiction-y techno music on the front, and we'll call this a day.
All right.
So thanks a lot for listening, and we'll catch you next time.